Welcome to Week to Week, the Political Roundtable program from the Commonwealth Club of California from Monday, November 30th, 2015. This was the week in which Senator Ted Cruz entertained a Texas church audience with his spot-on imitation of a scene from his favorite movie, The Princess Bride. I kid you not, watch it on YouTube. I don't know, you might change your mind about him. So thanks for joining us here in San Francisco today. I'm John Zipperer, your host for Week to Week and the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial. On today's program, we're going to talk about Donald Trump and the GOP, of course, but also the Democratic race, the political fight over Syrian refugees, the status of marijuana legalization in California, and a mix of other important political news. Of course, the Commonwealth Club of California is home to a lot of views across the political spectrum, so any views expressed up here are those of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. Now let's meet our panelists for today. Let's start at the far end of the stage with Carson Bruno. He's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. He's on Twitter at CarsonJFBruno. Next to him is making his week-to-week debut, Dr. James Taylor, Director of African American Studies and a Professor of Political Science at the Department of Politics at the University of San Francisco. And next to me is Carla Marinucci. She's a reporter and she produces the Daily Political California Playbook. Recently, formerly, you probably know her from the San Francisco Chronicle. She's now at the Politico.com. You can follow her on Twitter at @CMarinucci. You can also subscribe to her Daily Politico California News letter, which I heartily recommend. And it's not just because she's mentioned us in it. So, please use the question cards that are spread throughout the room to write down and submit any questions. I will try to ask as many as we can during this program. Now, on to our roundtable. And I want to kick off our discussion about Donald Trump, frankly, by hogging the microphone for just a bit. And I hope you'll forgive me. So Donald Trump has been at the center of this controversy over his claims to have seen videos of people celebrating the fall of the Twin Towers after 9/11, or in 9/11. A friend of mine works at the Associated Press in New York. Her name's A.J. Connolly, and she recently wrote, "A day or two after 9/11, we started getting calls in the newsroom about the workers at a store called National Wholesale Liquidators, where many of the workers were Indian immigrants." This is in New Jersey. They were supposedly celebrating the death and destruction there in their parking lot. At first, I ignored them because it seemed implausible, but they kept coming in, the calls, so I sent a reporter. The reporter called me from the lot where he saw nothing but parked cars. The next moment, another witness called in and insisted she was there watching the celebration. When I told her we had a reporter on the scene who would like to interview her, she hung up, confirming my assumption that she was not there and was witnessing nothing. A week or so later, and this is to me where the story really gets disgusting, a week or so later, the store owners, who were Holocaust survivors, asked to meet with the editors to express their dismay at these rumors. Not long after that, the store closed. The business was so badly damaged from the false accusations, it could not recover. It has been empty ever since. Rumors like this were rampant back then. Everyone that we chased down was false. If they were true, it would have been a huge story, the kind for which we reporters would, quote, sell our grandmas, unquote. She concludes, there is no footage and no archive reports because it didn't happen, unquote. So, panel, politics is a rough and tumble place where truth is usually the victim of attention seeking, but what do you make of the past couple weeks for Donald Trump? I mean, it is epic. Let me start with you, Carla.
I'm from the East Coast, where in Italian, so with the Teflon Don we knew as Don Gotti, but no, it's Donald Trump. I mean, it's unbelievable to watch. And I think, I have to say, I think the media, we're part of the problem. I only saw this last weekend Chuck Todd finally go after Donald Trump and really try to take him down and say, you gotta be kidding. I mean, yelling at him on Meet the Press, saying, you just can't say these things. You're running for president. He hasn't gotten that kind of challenge. There's plenty of stuff that's out on the internet all the time, and people believe it. The question is, what's true and what's not? He's been allowed to say stuff. Mm-hmm. I just think it's this angry voter out there, and they are going to go with him no matter what he says. It doesn't matter. The truth doesn't matter at this point.
I think you're right.
I think that's an important point. I think it is partial that he hasn't been challenged, both by the other candidates on the stage at the debates, or also, I mean, just on the campaign trail, and by the reporters covering the race. But also, it's that it plays well with the base that he is so far attracting. It's a populist, nativist base that is ready to hear these sort of things, whether they're true or not. And for them, they don't really care if they're true or not. They just want someone to finally be talking about them, because they think that sort of stuff is happening in this country.
Yeah, I think one of the low moments over the past couple of weeks would be where Kasich recently presented this footage or this ad that invokes Max Niemöller's comments about, you know, they came for the Jews, they came for the gypsies, they came for the union workers. I said nothing in all of these cases, and then they came for me. I mean, the fact that Governor Kasich would use such a language to invoke the implications of fascism as it related to Donald Trump, and others are beginning to throw this F word around in our politics, is not something to be taken lightly. This is a serious moment. The things that he's sort of suggesting in terms of surveilling certain populations of the community.
And what you're talking about there is he's, you know, he's talked approvingly of having national databases on all, first it was on, I think, all Muslims in the United States, then it was on Syrian refugees specifically, not aware that we already have a database on all refugees. That's what ICE does.
And so this was done before the polling, I think, that shows the recent bump that Trump enjoys as a result of these attacks. But I think if you look at this, the next round of polling, I imagine, is going to show some decline in Trump's appeal, because all of this, these recent, for lack of a better word, mishaps that he's been engaged in, I think are going to have a cumulative effect of impacting him negatively soon.
I'm not so sure these polls are going to go down.
Everyone's been saying.
Yeah.
They did over the past month and a half. Donald Trump flatlined, and Ben Carson went up. Donald Trump, in the internal metrics, everything was stagnant. And then you had these attacks that he clearly, according to all the research, benefited from most. Mm-hmm. But up to that point, Donald Trump was sort of sailing with nowhere to go, and Carson was on his way up. I think this bump that Donald Trump has, we'll see some of these establishment candidates to begin to move up into double digits. Ted Cruz is already beginning to do that.
I didn't mean to interrupt, but that's what a lot of people are saying is this: where this is going to go. That there's three paths here for the to the Republican nomination. That you have sort of the angry blue-collar white voter that's with Donald Trump at this point. You have on the other side the evangelical voters who look like they're going with Ted Cruz, and then down the middle, or such as center right, is Marco Rubio. And how this is going to play out, I think, is going to be fascinating. But, you know, remember, Trump started out, it was the Mexicans who were his target. That, you know, now he's...
Women first?
Well, you know, he's been all over. But, you know, he started out with the Mexicans, and now it's the Muslims. I mean, and it's just like, it's immigration, it's free trade, it's fear.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And you know, these polls are showing... Who are the supporters? 44% are non-college educated Republicans.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting.
And this is a problem for Trump and for the Republican Party. This is not a reliable group to hinge one's political campaign on. They will not show up in the polls. I think they gave Bill Clinton a victory in '96. We called it the election of the Corvair Moms.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a great deal of anxiety amongst this population, rightfully so. I think this recent report that came out of Princeton University that showed the mortality rates of the white working class who are poor and working class in the Midwest and elsewhere, and not because of natural causes, but because of alcohol and drug abuse amongst middle-aged white Americans. They are having unexpected, according to Princeton University, mortality rates. So this is a whole new announcement in the last 2 weeks that we have a new crisis on our hands of middle-aged, blue-collar, white mortality rates. And nobody predicted this. And this adds to the anxiety. So I think the pitch of the anxiety, add to that the problem of immigration, or the challenge of immigration. Add to that the browning of America in general, with the ongoing doubling of certain populations, the increase of African Americans from 45 million to 75 million in the next 40 years. A whole country is going to 400 million people in the next 40 years. 40 years, not 80. That means some of us in this room will still be alive, probably. I mean, my point is, you see how soon this is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about powerful transformations of our demographic realities, and I think this is all a part of that reality, that fallout.
It's too bad, I think, that political science is one of the few sciences where you can't do controlled experiments, because this race in particular would be fascinating to look at a bunch of different counterfactuals. Yeah. What if there weren't 14 or 15 candidates in it? What if, you know, Jeb Bush had somehow become a better candidate? you know, there's a lot of what ifs, because when you look at it, yeah, Trump's leading by a good measure, but he's still only in the 20 to 30% range. Yeah. And so that's saying, you know, 70 to 80% are Republicans. Yeah. Don't like him and don't want him to be
the
president.
You know what I think? One of the fascinating things is how skillful he is at playing the media. At this whole marketing thing that he's done his whole life.
Yeah.
It just plays every day. He's got another headline going. Mm-hmm. Today it's he wants CNN to give him $5 million to show up in the next debate because his ratings are so great. That he won't show up unless they give $5 million to his
favorite
charity.
I love that. He could be the first for-profit campaign.
then it was the meeting with the black ministers. Another one, which, you know.
The meeting we're not sure actually happened. We're not sure yet today.
Explain this one to me, because
half the ministers in the room met. The other half in the room didn't meet. Half endorsed him, the other half didn't endorse him. That really happened today.
He's just been, but the fact is, look, the Democrats are still going to be worried, because in the head-to-head polls, which I checked today, mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton is only is behind with Marco Rubio and with Ben Carson. And she's within margin of error with every other candidate.
Okay.
So
that is where you have to kind of question the polls if they're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All due respect to Dr. Carson, who's a brilliant surgeon. No, he did not beat Hillary Clinton in a head-to-head matchup. I mean, there might not be a single state in the union where you know, when it really came down to people getting into the booth. I mean, that's.
Yeah, I think we would all agree. I think Ben Carson has seen the height of.
I predicted. I mean, Herman Cain was dead by December 3rd in 2011.
Yeah,
I had predicted about 3 weeks ago on television here in San Francisco that this guy, Ben Carson, would be gone by the first week of December. I think, for all intents and purposes, his campaign is over.
Yeah. Okay,
so I think this is important because Nate Silver has done some great analysis on kind of when do polls really matter? When do they start actually being predictive? This entire summer has just been kind of just political fodder for really the media. It's the very few people who have been actually paying attention, like people like us, people like you, people who come to these sort of things. It's really kind of after Thanksgiving that you start to see the polling become more and more and more predictive of what the actual, not the actual outcome, but kind of the general outcome is going to be. So this is the time period to really start paying attention to, okay, who is moving? Who's moving in what direction? Because that's when that will give us some information about Iowa, New Hampshire, and then you have to start reassessing everything after that, because people start dropping out, and the polling is not very useful at that point. But the next few months will be fascinating to watch.
And let's get into that. So we were talking about this before the program. So the Iowa caucus is in at the very beginning of February,
right.
Soon thereafter is the New Hampshire primary, straw poll,
yes.
Swim meet, whatever they're going to do.
And then South Carolina.
Yeah.
South Carolina, Super Tuesday.
Okay, and James, you said you made a prediction on so we want you to predict here. Name a couple Republicans who will drop out after Iowa or New Hampshire.
All of the single-digit people, I hate to say that, because I really do want Kasich to show better. I think he would be a really formidable candidate. As
if
a governor of Ohio with the Electoral College votes, I think he has insider history, but he's had a local practical experience in Ohio, but I don't think he has a chance. I wish he did.
Yeah.
I think all of the single-digit people as we saw Bobby Jindal recently begin to
perform. Because the money will dry up if they can't
I think you'll see Rubio and Cruz benefit from that and begin to go up into higher double digits in the long run. I'm predicting, and I probably shouldn't do this publicly, but I've done it on television. I suspect Marco Rubio is going to meet Hillary Clinton, and Hillary Clinton wins. That's my prediction. Now, I don't know anybody else in the Bay Area who's willing from Stanford or Harvard or Stanford or Berkeley willing to put their rep on the line like that, but that's my prediction.
I think the big question I think is, when does Jeb Bush drop out?
I don't see
a path for him to be able to kind of resurrect, kind of do the comeback kid or the McCain, you know, Straight Talk Express sort of comeback. And so the big question is, when does he drop out? Because that will change the dynamic, I think, particularly for Rubio, the best, for the benefit Rubio the best. And that could give him the needed bump to be able to win a state before Florida comes around. Because if Rubio's not winning a state before Florida, Rubio's in a big problem, I think. I still think at this point Rubio's the strongest contender, has the best path to the nomination. Yeah, but you can't come out of Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina without a win and then expect to get the nomination.
Right, because Republicans haven't had a candidate who hasn't won in one of those states since 1976.
Right.
So you're right. Those are critical states. I think you have to watch Kasich. Arnold Schwarzenegger's communications director, Matt David, is now the head of Kasich's super PAC, and told me last week, when these ads came out, the gloves are off. They're going to go out. They're going to go like hardcore on Donald Trump. I think this is their moment, and they're going to try to do it in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
With Rubio, I think you're both right. He's an incredibly strong candidate. Maybe this is a baby boomer we're talking about, but it's like, I look at those ads and he looks 14 years old. I'm sorry. Right. I don't know. Right. Is it me? Yeah. So
he'll be the first millennial president.
When the New Hampshire paper recently endorsed Christie,
yes. Yeah,
they went after Rubio and said, we don't need another ambitious freshman senator who hasn't done a whole lot. We know where that's been. So I don't know if there may be some, issues.
Christie, keep your eye on Christie just to see what happens after this union leader.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that the union leader is going to give it to him.
I think the union leader endorsement is at this point not that important as it used to be because of the internet's influence.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And also I think it has a lot to do with the fact that the union leader, its impact on John McCain, for example, was 21 points. Mm-hmm. But the person who had, the second lowest person that they've endorsed in all time, had 4 percentage points at this point and received a 7 percentage point bump to 11%. So Christie is at 5%. So let's assume he gets on the low end 7%. He goes up to 12%. On the high end, 21%, mm-hmm. that would be significant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if he gets the 7%, then that's a problem for him in the long run.
Someone in the audience notes that Mitt Romney is tanned, rested, and ready.
You have to wonder if there's some kind of scenario out there where, I was in Iowa when McCain, came in those last few days, and we went to those rallies, and all of a sudden he just blossomed out of nowhere.
The problem's the filing deadlines. I think Florida's been passed, I believe. You have some of the bigger states that are approaching now. Virginia is a notoriously very difficult state to get onto the ballot. That's approaching rather quickly. A Mitt Romney scenario could potentially happen. Again, for a political scientist's dream would be a broker convention, which hasn't happened since the Ford Reagan situation. That really wasn't really a broker.
That's the journalist's dream, too.
Yeah.
But
that's the only way I could see a Romney situation kind of come into play, because it's too late in the game to get on the ballots in a lot of these states, I think. Even for someone as organized as the Romney machine really is.
Yeah.
And most of them have moved on to their candidates. A lot of them signed up with Rubio, some with Bush, some with Kasich. So it's, although crazier things have happened this election cycle.
You have the issue of, you have these super donors and the super PACs.
Yeah.
And that can keep these guys alive for a lot longer than, right?
As long as they have some money in their own bank account.
Yes.
They have to have some money in their own bank account to be able to keep some people on salary within their own operation.
That's right. But a Sheldon Adelson could keep somebody alive for a long, long time. So I think there's still a lot of surprises left in this.
And I go back to your earlier point. When you really break down the percentage of people really paying attention, it's about 6 to 8% of not even likely voters.
So you don't think that's different this year? I mean, look at the ratings for these initial debates. I mean, those were...
Yeah.
Primetime dramas would love to get those numbers.
And that might be the Donald Trump effect.
Yeah, well, I'm sure.
But how that plays out in terms of, the polls going forward.
Okay. We're still talking about just 14 million people nationwide. We're not sure where these people are actually watching from. Are they watching from Iowa, or New Hampshire, South Carolina? Maybe. That's more likely than not. But it's still
just before we leave the scenario, if I'm not mistaken, there was a situation where Bush, the father, was, I think he lost Iowa and then won New Hampshire. And I wonder if the son see that as a possible scenario for himself, that he could give up Iowa and just fight for New Hampshire and make himself viable as the guy coming out of New Hampshire. I think we saw that even recently in 2008 as well. The momentum.
The comeback kid, yeah.
Okay. Well, let me stick with you, James. The Financial Times newspaper this past weekend had an article about Republican Muslims who are very attracted to the party's economic policies, family values rhetoric, but are naturally appalled at the anti-Muslim rhetoric. So, James, you were talking at the beginning about all these folks who have been upset and insulted. Is there fundamental long-term damage being done? For example, the longer that this in-your-face kind of talk, the offensive stuff, continues, or, again, is it okay to have it happen now in the sense of the party's health, in that it's such a small percentage?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think in the long run, the damage is—I won't say irreparable, but I think the damage is serious. Across the board, it's not just alienating Muslims. It's alienating all populations that can identify in some way with the ways in which these populations are being targeted and focused on. I think with the Black Lives Matter movement, with the recent Occupy movement.
Explain what just happened with the Black Lives Matter.
Well, I mean, if we're talking about the shooting in Chicago, it's sort of just going to a whole nother level of intensity. This is after the movement has sort of shifted to the college campuses. I mean, this is a fluid and ongoing development in our politics. And I think in terms of, going back to your question, in terms of Republican Muslims, that's almost an oxymoron for me on some level.
How many are there?
I'm still trying to put my head around log cabin Republican, and that's been 25 years. So the idea of Republican Muslims, obviously, like Latino Catholics, you can find some religious identification around moral questions, but how that translates into a politics, especially in some place like Michigan. It's really, really interesting to see what happens. I think the more Donald Trump continues to speak and target and focus on Muslims, and there's not an adult that sort of says Trump is out of line, it will continue to push people further and further over into the column of the Democrats, or at least not in the Republican column.
Univision did a poll right after Trump got into the election, when he made all of his very inappropriate comments about Mexicans. And they asked him, what do you think about these comments that Trump made? And vast majority, something like 80%, said, they're offensive, they're terrible. And then they asked, do you think these are Trump's views or the views of the Republican Party? And just 14% said it's the views of the Republican Party. Still problematic, that's 14%. But it shows that at least at that point in the summer, that at least the Latino community was not connecting Trump's rhetoric to the party as the whole. Now, who knows how that's changed? I haven't seen a similar poll done since then. But I'm going to say at this point, I don't think it's necessarily the case, at least amongst the Latino population. I'm not sure about the Muslim population at this point, that they're not making that connection yet. I wonder, though, once votes start coming in, and once people start seeing Republicans actually vote for Donald Trump after saying all these comments, then does that actually impact people's perceptions of the party?
In the general election or?
In the primary. Okay. In the primary. We actually see Republican primary voters, caucus goers, voting for Donald Trump after saying very offensive, very inappropriate things. Do people then make that connection? Well, if Republicans are voting for him, then they must believe in what he's saying.
Yeah.
Does that harm the party? And I think there's a very plausible
rational case for that. I think this happens, a lot of things happen on a cultural level also. With the Donald Trump issue, particularly among young Latinos, because when you look at major ethnic groups, Latinos have had the historically the lowest turnout. Mm-hmm. But you're seeing now, much as with the Black Lives Matter movement, where young people were the ones that drove. In Latinos, you saw the Latin Grammys, major artists getting up with signs saying, we're not going to support this kind of racism. That kind of thing has a huge impact and an energizing effect on those voters. Yeah. And as a lot of people suggest, could wake the sleeping giant of the Latino vote.
But the other part of this equation is the black vote. It may not be important to Trump or to the Republicans in terms of their support for their party, but on the Democratic column, if you get enthusiastic black turnout, it could have a real impact on this turnout. If you look at 08 and 12, most people still haven't processed that the black vote in 08 and in 12, in unprecedented history, unprecedented in American history, the black vote outperformed every other group in America twice. Twice, and nobody knows it. And it was mostly, I think, at the local level in Pennsylvania, Virginia, and North Carolina, those voter ID suppression laws that provoke black voters to see that their grandmothers and mothers who couldn't vote in the 40s and 50s and 60s were now, before they leave this earth, being forbidden to vote again. Mm-hmm. I think the same kind of thing is going to happen to Republicans with women and these issues around Planned Parenthood. And the same kind of subterranean issue that doesn't seem to be as critical is going to mobilize these people at the end to have a devastating effect on the Republican Party.
Yeah. It's happened before. 1994, yeah. Prop 187 mobilized what are now called Prop 187 babies. They now run California's government. Kevin De Leon was one. Senator Ricardo Lara was one. Alex Padilla, our now Secretary of State, was one. These are people who were young college students when Prop 87 was on the ballot. They saw the Republican Party and Pete Wilson going gung-ho for it, and they realized, wow, I have to do something. The only way I can do something is to get politically involved, and they did, and now they really run the show in Sacramento. So I totally think that you're right.
And I think, especially your point on women and the Planned Parenthood issue, and I know we're going to talk about this, but that's another faction of this.
Yeah.
We've talked about it before here, which is, you know, one out of four American women have used the services of Planned Parenthood at one point or another, and whether or not some of these legislators understand that it's their own wives and daughters who are going to Planned Parenthood, that in many cases, I've spoken to many groups, you know, you could do it here and say how many of you women have either taken your daughters or, you know, and you're going to get a lot of hands. And I think that is an issue that really resonates with a lot of women voters on both sides of the aisle.
And you bring up Planned Parenthood, and this also can lead us into our discussion of the Democrats. Let's talk about what happened in Colorado Springs recently. There was over the holiday weekend, there was the shooting at a Planned Parenthood building there in Colorado Springs, killed three people, including a police officer. Some of the Republicans, Carly Fiorina, for example, have been very taken aback or expressed, you know, outrage that you would try to tie this to these imaginary videos that I talked about. Mike Huckabee, surprising to me because he has said some very outlandish things in the past, actually has gone pretty far in saying there's no way you can condone what happened. This, you know, it's dissociating himself and the pro-life movement from it. How big of a, and forgive me for making this a talking about this in political terms, but this is a political show. So how big of a political issue, problem, decision point is this, I guess, for some of the major candidates on both parties?
Well, I think it's one more case that points out so many dichotomies in our culture, right? We were talking about this before. How interesting is it that in Colorado, the guy who shoots, a cop and three people, I mean, a murderer, you know, a domestic terrorist, and comes out, you know, walking away peacefully arrested, Chicago, the 17-year-old is gunned down with 17 shots as he's already on the, you know, for holding a knife 10 feet away from.
And the entire political establishment sat on it for 400 days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that issue plays out. But then you've got, just today, Senator Boxer came out and said, these hearings in Washington, which they're going to have in Congress with regard to Planned Parenthood and defunding Planned Parenthood, she's saying that we should just end those hearings, that this has been a war on Planned Parenthood and it's got to stop. Kevin McCarthy came out today and said, no, we're going to continue with these hearings. He doesn't expect that it's going to result in a shutdown of the government. So you still got this partisan divide over this. I don't think that the rhetoric up there is going to stop with regard to this, and it's just one more thing that.
Do you think it's a landmine for Carly Fiorina? Anyone?
I think most people associated with her performance in the recent Republican debate, and she came out today in talking to Chris Matthews, I believe it was, and tried to distance herself. And much like I think Sarah Palin did when Gabby Giffords was shot in Arizona. If you remember, there were some comments that Palin had made right before she was shot that were almost predictive, like almost sort of sick 'em. And then when this happened, Sarah Palin pulled back and said, wait a minute, don't associate this with me. This is left-wing liberal media propaganda. And this is exactly what Carly Fiorina did today, attributed to left-wing hits. And as did Ted Cruz said, this is he was a left-wing liberal transgender. I didn't even read the article. I was just like, this obviously is clickbait. He's just joking around.
It's an Onion article. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. I think Republicans risk alienating a lot of their own people also in the response. I read the Susan B. Anthony's organization's kind of email about it today, and they were extraordinarily, very, very effusively condemning what happened, because you can't be pro-life and then obviously support something like this happening, regardless of whether politically you believe or ideologically you believe with what Planned Parenthood is doing. You just cannot, you reach a kind of a part in your brain where it just cannot function anymore, where you can support one thing but not the other. So I think you risk, and I think Huckabee kind of coming out against it kind of signifies that you would risk kind of alienating a substantive portion of pro-life individuals who, yes, are anti-abortion, but they're not radicals like this guy might be. We're still not sure really what prompted the attack. Obviously, there were many issues going on with him, but it is a landmine, and it only adds a new charge to the whole debate.
And doesn't it add even more fuel to the whole gun control issue? I mean, that, once again, we see this outpouring of grief and then nothing ever gets
done.
President
Obama said this cannot be normal or this cannot become normal. I'm sorry, it is
normal. It's normal.
I mean, this is what we're the country that has, more than one mass shooting every single day. It's horrifying that it's normal, but apparently Americans are...
It's a lot like a black-on-black crime.
Yeah.
And most people aren't willing to stop and pause and think about the fact that the country engages in the very same behavior it attributes to the black community. When we often see incidents of violence in Chicago, 50 a weekend, 500 a year, and then a single officer victimizes someone like this young man, everybody says, wait a minute, you guys are killing each other. Why don't you fix that? And we fail to recognize that America, on a national level, does the very same thing that it accuses the black population of America doing every time violence happens domestically in this country. Mm-hmm. America is hush-hush, just like the black community, on this internal violence. We are more afraid of ISIS than we are violence in the hood of America. Mm-hmm. If it's outside of the hood, it's a threat. If it's in the hood, it's some drive-by shit we can deal with. Excuse my language. We can deal with it because it's our internal problem, our American problem, our hood problem. Do you see yourself yet? But we're quick to say black-on-black crime is their problem. It's an American problem, first and foremost, not a black problem. But aside from that, most Americans engage in the very behavior that they demand black people, or in some cases, Muslims, when there's a terrorist attack, engage in, which is to straighten out the problems in your community. Mm-hmm. And we fail to recognize on a grand national level that America every day, 330,000 Americans have been killed by other Americans, according to Mother Jones, since 2004. 330,000 Americans have murdered other Americans. And let me correct this data. The majority of these were suicides by gun, but a large number of them were actually homicides. 770,000 Americans have shot one another, including suicides, since 2004. 300,000 Americans have been murdered since 2004 by other Americans. And you're going to talk to me about black-on-black crime? Mm-hmm. When the country every day does the same thing it accuses the black community of, not fixing your problem of violence in your country and in your community. We have it at the national level, what people say we have down in parts of this city. And we are not willing to see ourselves in a way that can begin to bring about reform and redress in terms of the serious problem of violence we have. Yeah. You didn't come for that, but I thought I'd just.
That was excellent.
Carson, as our Republican on the panel, let me switch to someone in the audience asks, assuming you think Hillary is the Democratic nominee, what role will Sanders' candidacy have? But I would I'm going to expand on the question itself, on her and the party.
Yeah.
Will he, or, I mean, she's kind of on cruise control right now. I mean, she's racking, Hillary Clinton is, you know, high in the polls. Mm-hmm. She seems to be solidifying both, you know, endorsements and
in my opinion, nothing has really changed when it comes to the Hillary Clinton candidacy. She was always dominant. She was always going to be dominant. Yeah, Sanders kind of surged there for a good part of the summer. But that makes sense. I mean, no party likes a coordination ever when it comes to a primary system. So naturally, there's going to be kind of a reaction to what is perceived as a political coordination. Sanders has an uncanny and a very, much like Trump, and I don't want to equate Sanders and Trump together, but you know, Trump is focusing in on this populist nativist sort of contingent of the Republican Party. Sanders, in a way, is kind of focusing on this socialistic isolationist sort of contingent of the Democratic Party. And he's doing a very good job at communicating that to a whole group of new people. Sanders never got into this race thinking he was going to win the nomination, let alone win the White House. I mean, that's not Sanders. He was in it to try to make a point on the issues that he cares very much about. Those issues are economic issues. So now he's not going to get into the whole ISIS and Syrian refugee thing. He's not going to get into foreign policy. He's going to talk about what he's passionate about, why he is a U.S. senator, why he's been in government for as long as he has, and that's what he views as kind of this democratic socialism that he had a very rather boring speech about a few weeks ago. I think his victory will be if he can win a few states, particularly the ones where you have a heavy white progressive voting bloc amongst the Democratic Party, Iowa, New Hampshire, Vermont, Wisconsin, being a few. If he can do that, then he essentially forces Hillary Clinton to take a position where she might not want to take, because the Clintons are they're hedgers. They don't really want to be tied down to any one position because they are political animals. And I'm not saying that in any sort of judgmental way, that they truly are. They understand how DC works. And DC works by compromise, by being social, by being traders and wheelers and dealers. And that's how any capital works, let alone, I mean, not just DC. So Sanders' victory will be forcing her to take positions on a lot of these economic issues that forces her to lock in those positions going into the general election, and if she wins, into the White House. And I think that alone will be Sanders will be very pleased by that. It could be problematic for her in the general election. I think it all depends on who the Republican nominee is that she's going up against. If it's someone like a Rubio who can talk about kind of the flip side of these issues very eloquently, very concisely, very intelligently, then she runs into a problem. If it's someone like a Ted Cruz or a Donald Trump, she might not run into that big of a problem by positioning herself on the progressive wing on some of these issues. I would actually throw Jeb Bush in that group too, because Jeb Bush has he's a really very smart man, but he's not very good at communicating what he's thinking in his head. So Hillary Clinton will be the nominee, barring some major barring her getting arrested by the FBI and found guilty before you know,
then you
March.
you might end up with Biden against Romney.
Right.
That'd be
you
fun.
Know, so. You know, it is interesting that Hillary's giving a big fundraiser tonight on the East Coast, and 14 Democratic, the Democratic women senators are there, except with the exception of one, and that's Elizabeth Warren, who has not endorsed her yet.
Hillary Clinton is very lucky. Elizabeth Warren, and I also throw Sherrod Brown, who the senator from Ohio, senior senator from Ohio. Either of them didn't get into that race, because both of them could do what Sanders is currently doing, mm-hmm. but take it the next distance.
Mm-hmm. Because they can really talk about stuff beyond just...
Exactly. You know. Yeah. And they're not as kind of that uncle you have, you know, sort of feeling about him. You know, they feel like they could be president.
Yeah.
Where Sanders, God bless him, he he really believes in what he believes, but for the mass population, you can't really see him being the person in sitting
in
the
I think when you talk about Hillary Clinton being on cruise control, one of the other interesting things about the fundraiser tonight is it's the first one she's done that's open to the press.
Wow.
And, you know, maybe some of you have heard me before on this, you know, it just really just bugs me that this has been a campaign that's been so close. We've stayed so far away from her. We haven't gotten anywhere near her. And I just think they maybe are starting to understand that she's got to have a more accessibility and be seen in sort of in some of these irregular settings. I think that's going to change, too. And I think that's another pressure from Sanders.
I think that's important, too. And I feel like people who have seen me up here before, you'll think I'm a broken record, because I always bring this up when it comes to Hillary Clinton time on the panel. I am surprised she hasn't and her campaign hasn't been spending more time very aggressively trying to deal with her weakness. And her weakness is trustworthiness, honesty. You see it poll after poll after poll. The general public does not think she is trustworthy by any measure. The drip, drip, drip of the email server scandal is contributing to that. But it's also, again, going back to the Clintons being political animals, it kind of makes them seem a little bit shady around the edges. And it's something that I think hurt her in 2008. It's something that Bill can get away from because he's such an effusive personality. But it's something that really has hampered her politically.
Yeah.
In really every race, it's just kind of been masked because her Senate races were in New York, and it's almost impossible for a Republican to win there federally. So I'm surprised they haven't been spending more time aggressively, and maybe this is kind of the pivot.
Be part of it.
They feel comfortable enough that Sanders isn't going to really challenge them when it comes to vote getting, and that they're going to start focusing now on making Hillary Clinton likable enough.
And I think, particularly with millennial voters, this is a problem.
Yeah.
If you talk to them, I've got two sons in their 20s, and this is not a crowd that likes Hillary Clinton, even the Democrats.
Yeah.
And remember, that was the coalition that helped Obama win: millennials, women, people of color.
Yeah.
And the worst thing you can do as a politician is to reinforce whatever the weakness, the perceived weakness about you is, the character flaws. You know, Mitt Romney kept on reinforcing that about himself.
And see, that's why I think if Bernie Sanders was serious about winning the nomination, he would just go negative.
Yeah.
Because they work. Negative ads work. And Hillary's, I think they say the ceiling is low and her floor is very high in terms of negatives.
Okay.
So, you know, there's plenty of opportunity to attack her, but I don't think...
He hasn't.
She's been vetted, obviously. There's probably not been a more publicly vetted person in American political history. Maybe FDR, I'm not sure. But clearly, Hillary, we know who she is. So we're not going to, unless there's some, we don't know, we can't imagine any more surprises coming from her, I imagine. So I think people are comfortable. And I added suggested earlier that in these primaries, the American public, through the voting process, even though it's the Democrats and Republicans, would make a choice amongst the Bushes and the Clinton, amongst Bush and Clinton, choose and vet one, and flesh one of them out during the primaries, because the country was exhausted going back to a Bush-Clinton rerun in 2015, 2016. And it appears that Bush is going to suffer and Hillary's going to be given an opportunity. And I'm not suggesting, well, I guess I did suggest early she'd win, but my point is she'll be in play to win. I think Bush will not. But the country, very carefully, we don't recognize this, has fleshed out between the Bush and Clintons.
Yeah.
They've pretty much made a choice, and now they'll choose from Clinton and whoever the Republicans can generate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I think we should move on to our next topic. And I should start this by noting that this Wednesday we're going to be hosting a town hall right here in this room on... what should be the most effective strategy for dealing with ISIS. Now, after the Paris attacks, there's been, of course, a lot of discussion and hullabaloo, if I can use an old term, over Syrian refugees. I think the United States was committed to taking in
10,000.
Yeah.
Compared to, 1.5 million Germany is expecting to take in. But, I don't know why. We don't have enough room here. Nonetheless, obviously this became an issue where we then had, more than half of the U.S. governors say they would not let, they would not settle refugees in their area. And of course, the Obama White House reminded them that they don't really have a say in that. Nonetheless, this has become a thing. And of course, it also touches in the whole, you know, relations with Muslim voters. I mean, when you're talking about who's going to vote for Hillary Clinton, I think quite a few of those Republican Muslims might be voting for her. But let's talk a bit about the politics of Syrian refugees.
Well, it is, I mean, it's so interesting. I mean, here's California, the most diverse state in the nation, and what did we take in, 200, I think we have here 200 Syrian refugees in total. You know, I think there's 16 in the Bay Area. I mean, the numbers are ridiculous, and the kind of vetting that they go through is years. And even here, Jerry Brown was kind of cautious, saying, you know, we're going to make sure. I mean, it is. I think that this may change as we get some distance away from what happened in Paris and the horrors there. But you know, you can't see these nightly newscasts of people coming in across the Aegean and children drowning, and not feel that that Americans are not going to open their arms to these people. And
it's in my opinion, it's amazingly anti-American to be anti-refugee, because you know we are the you know, the beacon of hope, that city on the hill. You know, we're the place where we were founded because of refugees trying to escape. You know, religious persecution. The pilgrims came here for, you know, safety. But at the same time, it's amazing that really in the entire history of, or at least modern history of the United States, public opinion has been anti-refugee. You know, during World War II, it was anti-Jewish refugees.
Yeah, during the Holocaust, I think it was 60% of the Poles.
You know, after the Iron, or after you know the Eastern Europe fell, Hungarians were trying to get here in droves. Americans were anti-Hungarian refugees, even though we were still anti-Soviet Union. Also, you know, the
but
Cubans.
Would you link that to stresses going on in the society at those respective times? Like, given that this is post 08 economic crisis, you know, when Reagan sort of, you know, sought to bring in more immigrants, there were tough times too, don't get me wrong, but I'm just wondering if you think economic factors.
I think so. I mean, if you look at then the Cuban refugees, the 60s and 70s, Vietnamese refugees coming right out of Vietnam.
Which Jerry Brown spoke out against at the time when he was governor.
So he did not want to take in. You are talking about very traumatic periods in history that are causing the refugees to be escaping where they're escaping anyway.
Not unrelated to U.S. policy.
Correct. But it's troubling, you know. It's something that's consistent over time periods and over generations, but it's still so anti-American in my view, that I'm amazed that so many across, and quite bipartisan actually, are supporting a lot of these restrictions.
Yeah. Okay. It's interesting to see Hillary begin to make a pivot and criticize the policy on ISIS. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, she's been one of the, you know, sort of felt like Obama has not been hawkish enough. Yeah. He's bombed seven countries, and he's being called weak for bombing seven countries. So I don't know what, I guess they want him to use a nuclear weapon, and then he'll be Harry Truman part two. I'm not sure.
Don't give him ideas. let's talk, I wanted to talk a little bit about the efforts to legalize marijuana in California. Now, this is a topic that's been around for a while, but I've been reading lately about there are a lot of different efforts that are going forward. There is, I guess, considerable dissension between them, or amongst them. There are 17 proposed ballot measures that have already been submitted and accepted. Now, considering the topic, I figure maybe half of those forgot they had already filed it. So that's a lot of proposals. I mean, Carla, can you tell us what
the
status is?
With 17 now, but you know, you do have some powerhouse groups now coming forward. And political figures, Gavin Newsom being one of them. And remember, he was the guy who said on same-sex marriage, whether you like it or not, it's going to happen.
It backfired.
It did backfire, but he was right. It did happen. And on marijuana, he's already, it's interesting to watch, as somebody who's a gubernatorial candidate, he's already done a blue ribbon commission on this. He's studied it backwards and forwards, and now he's come out and has the backing of Sean Parker, who's a billionaire.
Former
Facebook co-founder. So I mean, this is a very big effort, and I think you'll look for that. When we're looking at other states, Colorado, you know, making the kind of money. Right now, I've been told the entire school system in Colorado is now funded with the help of taxes generated from marijuana. Entirely. So I mean, this, when you're looking at that kind of money, California, it is whether you like it or not.
Yeah. What's really interesting, one of the books that I published recently was a book called Something's in the Air, Race, Crime, and Marijuana Legalization with two University of California professors. What's really interesting is people make certain assumptions about Prop 8, Prop 19. Yes. It's really interesting that African Americans were very conservative on marijuana legalization. If you look at the data in California, they were not in support of it as a majority. People assume it, obviously, they assume it. But if you look at the data, blacks were very conservative, along with Asians. Blacks and Asian Californians in general, I don't mean to, you know, put everybody in one bed, but Asians in general in California and blacks were the most conservative on legalizing marijuana in the state of California. And at the last minute, it was that Gavin Newsom commercial, whether you like it or not, we're here to stay. I mean, he couldn't have done worse if he had Willie Horton's face on it. But when he said that, he pretty much alienated a lot of young people at the last, in the 11th hour around Prop 8, marriage equality. Many young people bolted the campaign in support of it at the very end, and most people didn't detect that. So to assume that young people and African Americans are going to get behind the next effort, I think those who sponsor these programs have to, these initiatives have to do the groundwork, yeah, the footwork, and really look people in the eyes, meet them in their spaces, and talk to them about their organizations and their commitments before assuming.
Also, because I'm going to kind of shift towards the policy aspect of these initiatives. California's proposition or ballot proposition mechanics, mm-hmm, makes doing policy by ballot very tenuous, very, very scary from when it comes to kind of policy perspective, because it's very inflexible. You can only amend a ballot proposition by another ballot proposition unless the ballot proponents are smart enough to write into it to allow the legislature to amend it, which is very, very rare, because that's the whole reason why they're going to the ballot, is to not get legislature involved. And for something like marijuana legalization, it creates an issue where you have to have a near perfect bill, because there's a lot of tripping points, and I'll just say a few. If you start layering taxes and fees, all of a sudden, does that turn the legal product more expensive than the black market product, and does it actually solve the illegal aspect of marijuana? If you start exempting medical users, as the Gavin Newsom bill does, from all the fees and taxes, then does that kind of create a problem where everyone rushes to Venice Beach and gets, yes, their medical marijuana
definitely
card?
Definitely Venice Beach.
Right? Yeah. It's easy. I went to school at Pepperdine.
Me too.
I spent a lot of time at Venice Beach, and you walk up and down that promenade, and there are people just trying, they're begging you to come in and get your medical marijuana card. Unless you have medical marijuana reform to try to prevent that, which I think is very difficult to do, by exempting them from all these fees, then is that actually going to create the revenue that they're projecting it will? No, it's not, and you're going to have massive budget holes because of it.
Yeah.
You have to look at, if you start creating kind of employer kind of anti-discrimination laws around marijuana use, yeah, does that cause job market kind of disemployment effects, because then people are afraid to hire certain demographics because they might be more likely to be users and they can't fire them if they're actually using? Does it create, how about DUIs? Do we have the technology to detect stuff? What are the police powers when it comes to detecting this sort of stuff? What can juries and judges convict? It becomes problematic if these questions aren't thoroughly thought out. And thus far, a lot of the legalization propositions haven't considered any of these issues.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, in my opinion, that's been the major downfall of most of the propositions, because they're terribly written. What Colorado and Washington did right was they essentially left most of it up to the legislature to write the rules and regulations and parameters of these issues, which allows you to be imperfect because you can easily go back and fix the imperfections, easier to fix the imperfections. It'll be interesting to see whether the Newsom approach goes, because I believe it's being backed also by the same people that did Colorado and Washington's initiatives. It's a sticky situation, because If you vote yes on it and it wins, then you're stuck with what you've got until someone else comes around with enough money to try to qualify and pass another one. And then that's a toss-up.
Yeah, no. These are going to be huge money issues. And yeah. There's huge money at stake in California when you're talking about the kind of economy, which is a completely underground economy. Yeah. I mean,
there are serious benefits to legalizing marijuana. From the criminal justice perspective, from just... tax revenue, from funding these things, from there's water and environmental degradation because of the illegal market. But these questions really need to be, it has to be thought out.
It's going to be interesting.
Okay. Let's try to briefly get in a few things before we get to our news quiz. Can someone explain to me the story? I think most of you have maybe seen this. What was the deal with Governor Jerry Brown having state workers evaluate his private land for resources or something like that?
This was such a fascinating story. It's so interesting because, Governor Brown is going to Paris this week for the big UN climate change conference. And so we find out a couple of weeks ago that he had state workers look into his own. He has a ranch, a family ranch in Colusa County, about 2,300 acres, and kind of asked, hey, what's the drilling and mineral rights possibilities on this land? Wait a minute, Mr. Climate Change and no fossil fuel, want to know if there's oil. And he had the state delivered to him within 2 days, a 51-page in-depth report. And, of course, the Department of Conservation said, well, anybody can get this. So, any of you can write now to the Department of Conservation, I know this for a fact, and ask them to do a rundown on your land to see whether you have oil, mineral rights. And they do now actually run it down for you. You may not get the 51-page report, but the fact is this looked bad for the governor for every reason. And he has not yet explained why he wanted it. He is a history buff. And he may have just said to the guy, hey, I'm kind of curious, and they went crazy on him. But the fact is, it doesn't look good as he's going to the big climate change conference this week.
But you mentioned also he is going to this Paris conference. This is taking place right now in Paris. I believe it's 147 leaders are there from around the world. What does he hope to do? And he's not the only Californian.
No, what's fascinating
Why are they there? Why is Jerry Brown there? Why is Kevin DeLeon there? Why is Fran Pavley there?
It's a huge California delegation. And in fact, I thought it was so fascinating because they did a tweet that tonight from the White House press corps. We're there at the Place de Vosges in Paris at the most famous restaurant in Paris, a Michelin 3-star, where the average diner spends 400 euros per person to eat, and they were all eating there, apparently. Yeah. This is very important climate change stuff we're looking at
this
here. But the fact is that, yes, it's a very important conference, and Governor Brown has been kind of an international leader on this. Yeah. He's really spoken up on this. Some people say, hey, he's got a lot of stuff at home. Why doesn't he deal with El Nino first? That's really kind of an apocalyptic thing that's coming down the pike here. But what was interesting today and has a real sort of California angle on it is Bill Gates announcing this billion-dollar project that he's got. And the lion's share of the people involved are all from Silicon Valley. We're talking about Mark Zuckerberg, Mark Benioff from Salesforce.
Yeah.
It goes.
And this is
Tom
to
Steyer.
Use this money to do what?
Yeah. So what? And the University of California. Gates wants to use. Says, look, government can only do research, the kind of research we need. If government does the research, I'll find the investors. I'll find the money to develop the products that we need to help, produce green economy. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about some of the biggest billionaires in Silicon Valley, John Doerr, Vinod Khosla, two major venture capitalists. This kind of money and these kind of people who have the cash to put into electric cars, other huge advances in green technology. And the fact that Silicon Valley has such a huge role in this, I think, is just fascinating.
I joke when I say what are they doing there. It is a little bit of a vanity show for a lot of the Kevin DeLeon, particularly Fran Pavley. They've been really vocal people in state politics on these issues. Jerry Brown has been a kind of a thorn in the Republican Party's side on this issue.
Calling them troglodytes, Luddites, yeah. You know.
But again, like, why are they there? Like, they can't negotiate for the United States. The U.S. negotiators aren't going to be listening to them. They have their own agenda, their own priorities, their own marching orders from the White House. But I'm not. But it's important. The Paris summit is important because take California, for example. California is 6% of the U.S.'s the U.S.'s carbon emissions. The United States is 16% of the globe's emissions. So California, if California were to get rid of every single carbon emission tomorrow, it's going to adjust the global carbon emissions by 1%. California alone is meaningless in this fight against global climate change if carbon emissions is the culprit, and there's a lot of evidence to suggest there is. So Sacramento can pass every single climate change law they want, and they're going to do really nothing to the problem. So you have to get a global initiative started. You have to make it so everyone is putting some skin in the game, because otherwise you're just kind of twiddling your thumbs and making it more difficult for your economy to run, because that's really what's happening in this state, at least.
Okay. Well, then let's go on to our news quiz. Fran can come up here, and she will deliver chocolate to people who win. Now, if you've never been here for this, let me quickly explain. I'm going to ask a question. If you think you know the answer, please raise your hand. Don't just shout it out. I'll call on you, and if you're right, Fran will be the little chocolate Santa. Okay, first question. Who is Robert Louis Deer? I saw your hand first, ma'am. He is he's the man who killed three people during the shooting at a Planned Parenthood building in Colorado Springs. While we're doing people, let's say, who is Christopher Kors and why is he in hot water? This is a local story. Anyone see this? Sir?
He's the cop from Castro.
He's the police officer from Castro involved in a hit and run. What is he known as? The hot cop, yes.
The hot cop of the Castro.
Okay. After a group in Texas held an armed protest outside a mosque, what did it do online? Did anyone see the story, ma'am?
I believe it posted the names and addresses of Muslim sympathizers.
That's right. They posted the names, addresses, and other data of local Muslims. This is in Texas, an anti-Muslim group. Where did the gun come from that was used to kill a popular Oakland mural painter? In the yellow back there. Right, it was an immigration officer's car. So if you want a gun, that's where you should go. In the yellow on the other side, thank you. Pope Francis. Can't have a news quiz without a Pope Francis question. The Pope has followed in the footsteps of Van Halen, Starship, U2, and others by doing what this week? Sir? No, he might be. He is in Africa, you're right, but that's not what he's doing with them. Or after. Actually, I want to try to get someone who hasn't already answered, just to try to be safe or fair. No, but he might do that. I mean, he should donate Benedict's shoes, because those are really nice. Okay.
He did that.
I can't say Van Halen. Way in the back.
Well, he went there because Christians are being killed by Muslims.
This is something, listen to the whole question, though. He's following, maybe I shouldn't say following in the footsteps. He's doing something that Van Halen, Starship, U2, name a bunch of other rock singers, have done. What has he done this week? It's not something you would expect a pontiff to do. Ma'am?
He's tweeting.
Nope. He's been doing that for a while, though. Yes?
He released a Christmas record.
I'm going to give it to you. He released a rock album. That's true. Right there in the middle, Fran.
I didn't know that.
I'm not saying it's any good. I'm just saying it's available on Google Play.
Yeah.
It's called Wake
Google
Up.
Play.
Well, elsewhere as well.
I gotta
okay.
Check it out.
Hillary Clinton is heading to Omaha, Nebraska, where she will stump with what famous supporter of hers?
Oh,
sir? Warren Buffett. That's correct.
That's right. That's right.
Just a few more. Let's go to looking to cement its new alliance with Russia as well as propel its war on ISIS, France has indicated it is taking a softer line on the removal of whom? Yeah, I'm going to have to give it to the gentleman in the hat, sorry. Bashar al-Assad in Syria. And what number were we at there? The gentleman in the hat. Third row. There's so many moving parts to this.
It's it's dangerous.
Let's see. One more. Okay. See how well you're following state news. Now, California might be locked in a historic drought, but that didn't stop San Rafael, California from doing what on Saturday? Come on, my Marin County people. Gentlemen in the back. A mere 42 tons of snow on the streets for its annual winter holiday. That is correct. Listen, we're going to have more news quiz questions and, of course, a lot more to discuss in 2 weeks right here on Monday, December 14th. It's also our annual holiday member social, so please show up for that. Thank you to our panel, Carla Marinucci, Carson Bruno, and Dr. James Taylor.
Thank you.
Thanks to all of you here in the audience and everyone listening online.
That was fun. Thank you.
Have a great week, and we'll see you next time. Great.